Okay, folks, we are going to move on now to agenda item 4. Fabienne is going to introduce the determination of cash equivalents. Okay? And if anybody else wants to speak, will you please wait your turn and talk into the microphone? Thank you.
Good morning. Agenda paper 4 is a paper that brings back an issue from last meeting. There is an addendum to agenda paper 4 that is due to late submission on an issue that relates to the classification of cash equivalents. That's why we put the papers together. The idea being that the agenda decision that we've written for agenda paper 4, we wanted to determine whether this agenda decision was consistent with the analysis carried out in in the addendum to agenda paper 4. Going back to agenda paper 4, the objective here is to provide the requested additional analysis and to determine whether or not the definition of cash equivalents needs to be amended in IS 7. The staff asserts that the money market fund unit subject to the original submission do not strictly meet the criteria to be cash equivalents because the instruments are not convertible to a non-amount of cash at inception. And then the analysis goes on with the fact that the staff believes that the short term and the conversion into a known amount of cash at inception are indicators of the risk of changing value, which is specifically stated in the definition of cash equivalent in IS 7. The staff also considered in the paper the requirements under US GAAP 95 with respect to the assessment of risk of changing value, and the staff noted that the US GAAP referred to the risk arising from changes in interest rates, which IS 7 does not make such a reference. However, the staff believes that potential value changes are not limited to changes arising from interest rate risk. So we then believe that no amendment to the definition of cash equivalent in IS 7 is needed, and let's see if we could agree with that.
Thanks, Fabienne. Any comments from the APRIC members? Anybody disagree? No? Always nice to get full agreement. That's a very clear presentation. All right, we've had one vote for a very clear paper, now a clear presentation to introduce it. Ken's going to say that it should be added to the agenda, are you?
No, Chair, I don't want to sort of stop your home run. I'm completely in agreement with the proposal. I do have a comment on the addendum. Were we going to discuss that separately? Yeah. Okay.
I think if you've got some comments on the addendum, we should take it now, because we're going to make a decision overall as to whether to add this to the agenda or not.
As regards to the addendum, I do have a concern about the staff conclusions in relation to the addendum. I have the concern in that I hit a different but sort of comparable issue recently in practice, and I actually tried maintaining exactly this position. I phrased it slightly differently, but I think it's the same thing, in that I argued that you had a fixed amount that was a known receivable amount, and what you actually had was a contingent asset alongside it that it would go along. And the more I tried to argue that, the more I found it difficult to argue. But I think ultimately, if you take that approach, where would you draw the line? So that you you invest 100 million and there is a floor of 50 million or something you'll get back, and it bears some sort of variable interest rate, but there's also something else that could wipe out the top 50 million, I think. You say, well, I know I'm going to get back 50. And so I do have difficulty with this argument, and I say that having tried to maintain it myself and found that I just as I dug in further and further, I find myself less convinced. So I'm not convinced by the addendum.
Well, we should heed that as a warning then, because if you were not sufficiently persuasive in that circumstance, then we have reason to be concerned. Ben?
To me, the case in the addendum looks a little bit like an embedded derivative. Did you think about that at all?
We didn't go that far because mainly we took the view that that as far as instruments seem to have the same characteristic as demand deposits, then we strongly believe that these are cash equivalents, and we analyzed the situation as being that way. So
I agree for the part that is the fixed deposit and that will be paid back in full, but the part that is the interest rate is dependent on when you pay back. So you have either an interest rate of X or X minus Y, and this looks to me like an option or something like that.
Well, it's certainly a feature of the financial instrument that determines the rate that you would receive, but I don't, in a sense you can call it if you want a component, but never go quite so far as to call it an embedded derivative that you consider accounting for separately. But
I don't want us to tell people to separate it, to bifurcate it. I just want to raise the thought.
Well, as far as the addendum is concerned, my understanding of the staff recommendation is we don't need to do anything because the existing agenda decision covers it. And I wasn't sure that was the case because the fact pattern in the opening paragraph of the tentative agenda decision doesn't cover this fact pattern. And I suppose more generally, I was interested in the comments by the staff that management intent is not one of the criteria for an instrument to qualify as a cash equivalent in paragraph 13 of the paper, whereas I mean, my reading of paragraph 7 of IS 7, cash equivalents are held for the purpose of, kind of implies intent to me. So I wasn't sure about that bit of the analysis. But I don't think the existing gender decision covers this situation.
No, I think the gender decision in paper 4 was written for the circumstance in paper 4. The addendum came through later, but we didn't modify that decision. I was suggesting that we consider both papers together to determine if we want to take it onto the agenda, and given that we either do or don't, we can then look at the wording of the agenda decision. But Jean-Louis first.
Yeah, I had about the same type of difficulty as Ben, because I think I'm not in disagreement, but if we are speaking of a specific type of instrument with a fixed interest rate, you capitalize even the interest rate. So when you speak of the known amount of cash known at its inception, that's not true because it's changing with the capitalization of interest. And if the interest rate changed the value of the instrument rate, so the instrument is changing value and it could have a different value from the original value, but still equivalent to cash. So
again, Jean-Louis, we've got to be careful here, because if you have a deposit in a variable interest account which varies according to LIBOR or some other benchmark rate, then you don't know the amount of the interest you're going to get at the inception of the loan. But what you do know is that the capital is protected, and that's assured that the change in the interest rate, because of either the nature of the interest reward, or the term, if it's a fixed interest item, is sufficiently short that you're pretty much assured that there is little or no risk of a change in the value of the item due to changes in interest rate risk. So it's we're looking at a whole series of words in here. So it's not that you know all of the cash flows that you will eventually receive.
I agree on this, and I agree on the fact that we should know, not enter into the discussion we had before about the transparency of the fund and maturity with linked with the transparency. So basically, I agree.
I had a similar concern as Andrew in respect of the reference to management intent, because I thought in reaching our conclusion on the first topic, we had regard to paragraph 7 of I7, which spoke about cash being held for the purposes of having cash on hand as opposed to making an investment. And I think, well, certainly in my mind, that was a key thing in arriving at the conclusion that we did. So I was a bit concerned when there was the argument almost to the contrary in paragraph 13 of the staff paper, and then extending it into to paragraph 14, I could read the staff conclusion to apply to any debt investment for any term. And I'm not sure that that's what the staff intended, but I could read paragraph 14 to say, well, any debt investment that you've made where you know you're going to get your principal back could meet the definition of a cash equivalent, because we don't seem to have had regard to the term.
Again, to correct, one of the characteristics is that you can get your cash back on demand. So it's not just a five-year fixed interest rate or variable interest rate deposit. It's an instrument that allows you to demand back in the same way that a cash deposit would allow you to demand that back.
Any redeemable investment then, even if it has a term but allows you to redeem, would meet the definition of a cash equivalent then?
I'll turn the question the other way around. What do you think is the difference between that and a cash deposit? I'd say if you want, and I don't think it's management intent. I read management intent differently. I think that is that you don't necessarily have to go through a formal designation as you would with held to maturity or available for sale. But that if management has placed funds in an account where it can be used as cash, where they have access to it, free access to that cash, then I would expect management, following good stewardship, sorry Andrew, that was just for you, following stewardship principles, to try and maximize the amount of return whilst retaining the flexibility. So cash in a deposit account that pays zero interest is one thing. That certainly is cash or cash equivalent. If that same deposit is put on a form that, if it's needed, it's available at little or no interest return, but if it's not needed and it's kept there for a month or 2 months or 3 months or 6 months, that there's a high rate of interest that's earned, then I would think that that is prudent financial management. But it doesn't change the fact that it is available as a cash equivalent.
That's where I think paragraph 7 comes in, because when you look at these particular instruments and the fact that they play with interest and you get a penalty if you take it out early, for example, you get no interest if you take it out early. To me, that goes to what management intent is in paragraph 7 is, I'm putting this money in because I need it to meet my short-term cash needs, or I'm putting this money in for investment purposes, and the longer I put it in, the more interest I get. There must be something in in the board's mind in paragraph 7 that distinguishes between those two situations. And if there isn't, then you'd have to accept any type of investment that you've described as a cash equivalent for any term. And I'm not sure that that was the intention.
Well, before Scott closes the point, I mean, isn't that the intention, that things that are the same economically should be accounted for the same? And management intent shouldn't change the form of that.
I was just going to raise the point. I thought that the key here is redeemable on demand, not stated exactly, but I think something that is redeemable at par at any time is a cash equivalent, even if you don't intend to redeem it. The piece that I think actually can be a bit confusing here is, let's assume that you have such an investment. You do your accounting as if you are not going to redeem it, and therefore you will receive the interest, and therefore you recognize interest income and accrete the balance in this account if you include the entire balance as a cash equivalent, now you have the wrong amount as a cash equivalent. The only amount that's a cash equivalent is the par, the redeemable amount. So I think you actually have to bifurcate the classification. You don't need to do derivative accounting on it, but I think Berndt is right that we actually, the interest receivable, as it were, has to be accounted for separately in this case.
Yeah, we didn't get into that level of detail, and that's, we were trying to do something, but we thought of it, and we agree with you.
I basically agree with Ruth, and picking up Scott's point, I just like to take it to its logical conclusion, because if you read this as you're reading it, Chairman, and I do believe that you've got characteristics, and you've got the things like the 3 months to sort of say this will be an indicator, and they're trying to get to the characteristics. If you say, well, it's just repayable on demand, I'm a company, I know I'm going to have a sum to pay in the near future, and therefore it's a large sum, I put some money on deposit, and I put it on deposit, it's repayable on demand, but I get a better interest rate if I take it on terms that say, should I demand it before some period of time, and the period of time will progressively take, I lose the interest. So I get a better interest rate by putting it on, because I think I'm not going to need this money for a couple of years, but I might. So I put it on for 2 years. I'm 18 months in. I've got a significant amount of interest now wound up into it. I am not going to suffer that penalty. If I need the money now, I won't take it out there. But I would still get it back at par if I took it. Now I've got a significant variation from what I have then got, because I'm now several years in. I think within the first 3 months, the variation's minor. But if I'm 18 months in, the variation's enormous. But it's still repayable at par. I can call it any time at par. And that's where I think this gets it wrong. I think the things like the 3 months are put in to give some constraint around that. And I think we're starting to ignore that.
With respect to the 3 months, I thought, and maybe I am wrong, I thought that an instrument that was puttable in 3 months but doesn't mature for 2 years is still a cash equivalent. So it seems to me we've already answered the question as to whether maturity needs to be within 3 months. I do agree one could read the whether it is subject to significant changes in value or not, the impact of this penalty could be thought of as a change in value, but I didn't think that that played into the 3 months issue. I thought that puttable within 3 months has already been deemed to be sufficient.
I think that the staff's view of the 3 month thing was basically because so much of these kinds of investments are going to things like commercial paper that are sold at a discount at fixed rates, that if you get much longer than that, there is a potential for a shift in interest rates to significantly affect whether or not you would actually get back the amount you invested, which is where I think the staff was coming from. So to your point, Ken, about I invested 100, but I can any time get back 50, to me wouldn't make the 50 that you get back at cash equivalent. This is all about, to Scott's part, that you would be able to get back what you put in with little risk of it shifting. So I agree with Berndt and Scott's analysis that says that the amount that I can get back, the amount I invested that I can get back at any time at par is the part that would qualify, and to the extent that you have accrual for longer amounts, those would not, if significant, would not qualify as cash equivalent.
See, I do think the variation is an important test. I think that's part of the definition. And I think if I'm in a position where I can get it back, whether it's par or something less than par, but if I do take it back now, it will be a significantly different amount from what I would get if I left it a little bit longer. I think that's a significant variation.
And I think we may have some problem with the original decision and not just with the addendum. For example, in these investments in these money market funds, my understanding is that the units are always priced at the same amount and don't change with changes in net asset value, that they manage that by issuing new units. So you can always get that the unit price is always fixed, and if you put in 100 and you earn 5 of interest, you get units worth 5 more. So in that case, we've got an issue, because you put in 100, you can always get the 100 back. You get 5 more worth of units, and you can get those back too. Now, which piece of that qualifies as a cash equivalent?
But that's where I thought the 3 months came in, because the 3 months will mean that it's relatively small.
But none of these have maturity. Those units have no maturity. They are redeemable on demand for that price. So the question is, do I have to worry about how often they adjust the unit numbers to keep it at par? Do I need to worry about that I can get back my original 100? Do I need to worry about whether I can take out the other ones? And to our way of thinking, that to avoid all of the discussion that we had last time about looking through how the fund works, the key issue was to say, in the similar line as the addendum, can I get back what I put in at any time without any risk of change, ignoring the fact that while I hadn't been invested, I might have gotten 5 more units. That's why we think that the issue raised in the addendum is very similar to the issue that we had in the first paper, and didn't think that we needed to put a lot more discussion around what was in the addendum.
Well, I think if you've got a company that's invested a deposit or a debt instrument for 5 years and has no intention of using it short term, albeit technically repayable on demand, to insist that company shows that investment as a cash and cash equivalent seems to me pretty tough, frankly, and that's why I think intent is relevant. And I know it's only for example, but the words in paragraph 7 talk about preferred shares acquired within a short period of their maturity. So I was surprised by this turn of events in the paper about intent being irrelevant, as I mentioned previously.
Of course, the recommendation of the staff is that we don't actually change the wording of the standard anyway, so intent would stay. What you seem to be saying is that perhaps not in our agenda decision, but in our own minds, we need to clarify that if management has an intent of investing in something, for example, of 5 years, that regardless of the terms which may allow it to get its original capital back, that is not something that they will consider to be a cash equivalent. But if it's of short duration, where the amount of the interest is relatively insignificant, or if it's of a duration where the interest is reset or repaid, so every 3 months, so the amount of the interest would not be significant anyway to the carrying amount of the item, then in those circumstances, something that is repayable at par, at its carrying amount, or close to its carrying amount, insignificant risk of price change, it's all consistent with what IS 7 says at the moment, and those types of instrument would be cash equivalents.
Well, I mean, just hearing the discussion, I think my preference would be to stick with the existing agenda decision on the existing fact pattern, and we seem to have unearthed some other considerations that maybe require further discussion as a separate topic.
We might need to do that, but I think we're overcomplicating it. I think this discussion, what we're talking about is bifurcating an instrument into the cash equivalent component and the other component. And I think that's overcomplicating what IS 7 had in mind. And we're then going down, getting mixed up in IS 39 and the measurement of the instrument and all sorts of things, which I don't know that we need to do that. I think we could just deal with it clearly and simply and refer to Paragraph 7 of IS 7, talk about the intent, talk about duration, without going into overcomplicating it with the other one, because I don't believe that that's what was in the mind. Well, if anyone's here who wrote it, was that in the mind of the standard setters when they wrote IS 7, that they that they would contemplate these longer term instruments and bifurcate them?
I can't imagine that anybody it would ever get significant enough that you'd end up bifurcating it. That is obviously technically the right answer. And I also don't think that you would force people to put things into cash equivalents. Usually people want things in cash equivalents, and the standard is there to keep them from putting things that shouldn't be in cash equivalents in. So it seems to us that we were trying to, I think, say essentially the same thing that Bob did, which is we don't think that the standard, the sentence in the standard that talks about intent is the same kind of intention that requires management representations and documentation and all the other kind of stuff that goes with intent in 39, for example. It's just to say that this is generally speaking what you do, and that's here's the things that make it look like something that you would include as cash. And I agree with Ruth. We didn't think that this was a huge difference from the kinds of units that we were talking about in A, which is why, or in the main paper, which is why we thought that we could try and bring them together and deal with them both at the same time. But if people think they're a significantly different question, we can do with one and come back with the other one later.
The point about forcing or people wanting to do it and suggesting that I have a real problem with the concept that somebody puts something in for 10-year money where you could have a significant amount of accumulated interest after 9 years and they're a bit short of cash and they want their balance sheet to look better and they've been pushing something into investment and they say, okay, actually, I know that I could redeem this at par. There's no way I'm going to do because I'm going to lose a hell of a lot of interest if I do. I'm going to lose a huge amount. But I'm allowed to put it into cash equivalents to make my cash look better. That gives me a real problem.
Maybe what we haven't articulated as well as we should, because we weren't trying to develop an interpretation to explain this, but I think your concern would be addressed if we were to say cash equivalents are something that are not cash at the reporting date. So it's something that could become the same as cash immediately subsequent to or within a short period after the reporting date. That's the redeemable on-demand pot. And as long as there's an insignificant risk of change in the carrying amount at the reporting date, then I think that would cater for your concern. Because if you've got 9 years accumulated interest, you can get your original investment of 9 years ago back. However, the carrying amount today is 150. If you can only get back 100, then that sounds like other than an insignificant risk of a change in the carrying amount. So I don't think we weren't trying to develop completely, but I think that would address your point.
But that is where you're taking us, Chairman, and I do come back to Andrew's point. I have the same difficulty in year one when I haven't got that huge amount accumulated. If my intent is that I'm going to leave it in there, I really don't think it should be in cash equivalent.
I'm going to force the question first. Do you want to take this item onto the agenda? Staff is recommending that we don't. Is there anybody who disagrees with the staff recommendation? Right. So that can help us to come to a conclusion a little bit more quickly, I think. Then we've got two fact patterns that came to us. There's the original one in paper four, and the staff had proposed wording for the agenda decision relating to that fact pattern. Does anybody have any concerns or major recommendations to make on that agenda decision in the light of the facts in paper four? Ruth?
I would like us to refer to the person. So I'd like us to refer to para 7 in IS7 and to short term somewhere in there. And I think that will help people resolve the question in the addendum.
So short term, you'd refer to the instrument should be a short term instrument?
Yes.
By which you mean less than 12 months?
Well, in IS7 it says less than 3 months.
What about instruments like the ones that were raised in the question that we're answering here that have no maturity at all? So then you actually don't agree that units and money market funds can be cash equivalent.
I would object changing the wording for rejection. I would object changing the wording for rejection, including the a term, because if we are including a term, you imply transparency through the fund and looking to the individual lines, and because there might be or there will be no maturity to the fund, so I will object on that because it's changing very substantially what we have written.
I think they are cash equivalents, and I think we should leave the wording as it is. And I would not refer to the paragraph 7, actually, because it is not clear that the 3 months is a really hard and a fixed period. It says normally, say, 3 months, that's rather weak. So we could not introduce a fixed deadline that has not been in the standard before.
A number of things that kept crossing my mind here. Now I'm concerned about the wording because Ruth kind of liked the wording, but she thought the answer to the submission was that shares in money market funds are never cash equivalents. I didn't think that's what the agenda decision was trying to say. Okay. So there, but Chris brought up the point that these things don't have maturities, and you said then they wouldn't be. But I thought that the point of the agenda decision was that they don't literally have to have a maturity if they are redeemable. So what is the point? I thought redeemable has long been considered to be sufficient. Right. And I do take, as I mentioned earlier, on the addendum, I do understand the changes in value part could be an issue, but I thought that the redemption part handled the issue of not having a literal maturity. And as long as we're comfortable with that, I like the wording in the agenda decision as it is for the original issue that was submitted.
I also agree with the proposed wording. I think the redeemable portion is a requisite to have cash equivalent. The change in value is the real issue, and I agree with comments that were made that if I invest for 2 years, 1 year, whatever, I would see the change in value criteria to include the interest rate. Because you know, cash equivalent is something that I could use without restriction at any time. That's what cash is. When I have cash, I take it and I pay my accounts with. If I have any significant amount of interest accrual that I'm going to lose, then I have an impediment to use my cash, and then I think it loses its cash. The smell test is that this may not be cash. It's an investment that has a change in value if I cash on it. So for me, I agree with the first part. And with respect to the addendum, I believe I have an issue with the long-term investment of cash, even though they are redeemable.
I agree with the root point that, in my opinion, there is the need to reference paragraph 7, because we are not speaking about cash, but we are speaking about cash equivalents, and the perspective of the investment made is one of the elements that is necessary to include inside the other elements in order to define if you satisfy or not the definition. The tentative agenda decision says we do not include this in the agenda of the IFRIC because we think that inside the present rules there are sufficient guides to arrive to the appropriate conclusion. And I agree that we are not saying that in this case all these cases are outside. We are saying that often are outside, but there could be some elements that we have to consider it in order to make the appropriate classification. In this sense, one is that there is a small amount of risk. The first one is that there is a time lag that you have to consider it in your decision. I believe that we should represent all these three elements inside which reference to paragraph 7. Otherwise, it seems that the tentative agenda decision is not well supported on the analysis that we have made now.
Ms. What was the first point, right? The first condition? Purpose. So it's important that management says that if they have a 3-month commercial paper, that they have to indicate what the purpose of holding that paper is, that they must say that they're holding it as a cash equivalent.
But they have to consider if they have made this investment for the purpose of meeting short-term cash commitments rather than for an investment or other purposes.
Yeah, I'm just trying to be clear, Luca, because I read that as this is the way that the business is managed. It, finances are managed in a way that gives it the flexibility to do that, as opposed to the purpose of each individual investment is one thing or another. Like the purpose of the 10-year bond is actually to accumulate an increase in value over a 10-year period.
Can I follow up on something that Jean said that just struck me? Because it seems that if we, and I think this is something that Ken was getting at too, the key thing that we started with here was to say at any point, certainly at the date that I make the investment, and the thing that we were trying to clear up was something can't be a cash equivalent just because you can cash out at any point, no matter what the amount is. It's the known amount of cash at the front end is the key thing that we were trying to deal with as part of this. So that, and there's little risk of changes in value of that amount for whatever time. But I think what I'm hearing you say is that at a certain point in the life of something that's longer than that 3 months, that the change in value judgment would be related to what I would get compared to what I have it on the books at, which is Bob's carrying. We don't want to use carrying amount because that would be perhaps a trading value to somebody else that could hold it for longer. But I think that, does that help deal with people's concern about the term?
I don't think that goes far enough. And just thinking about this, another problem, I hear you just said you don't want to confuse with what somebody else could get if they could hold it longer. But let's say that I enter into a 10-year instrument with a fixed interest rate, and I've not held it for very long, and interest rates drop enormously. I've then got an instrument which I could be carrying at fair value, or I may be carrying at cost. But because interest rates have fallen, its value has gone up enormously. Now, I might have a redemption right at par, which would be a very foolish thing to do, though the lender would love me to do that. I would have difficulty considering that as cash equivalent, because I have something whose value is susceptible to very significant change. I've got 10-year money at a really good interest rate. So to my mind, that is subject to significant change, and that could happen within a very short period of time of having taken the thing out. So I see this criterion as subject to significant variation as one of two significant criteria. And you can be subject to significant variation either because it's got value that's far beyond its nominal value because it's got a fixed interest rate or something, or it could be subject to significant variation because you've just left it there accumulating interest for a long time. There's all sorts of ways. And I think we're coming back to this principle, and I say it was a principle I tried advocating on something else. Coming back to a principle, if I've got something that has a fixed value with a contingent asset, albeit that contingent asset could be very, very valuable, that I can, because it's got a fixed amount, I can say it's price per vary. Don't think that's true when the contingent asset has become very, very valuable.
Ken, I think the situation you were describing, if I follow correctly, that would apply even if the redemption amount at any point in time was par plus accumulated interest. If you had a bond that paid interest every 6 months at a fixed rate, you would say, well, even if you could redeem at par plus accumulated interest, you wouldn't do so if the interest rate environment had switched such that it was in your best interest to not redeem it. That would suggest then that puttable is insufficient. And my understanding of practice would suggest that would be a huge change.
Yes. In relation to the first, before the addendum topic, I totally agreed, and I agreed with the wording that was actually there in the second paragraph. I had a suggestion for the third paragraph, which was, this may actually help the addendum issue, which was, I'm using my word judgment again, so you may disagree on that bit, which was the effort noted that how an entity makes, effectively repeating Fabienne's paragraph 10 in her memo, which is the effort noted that how an entity makes the determination is a matter of judgment, however, satisfaction or otherwise of the criteria should be clear from the terms and conditions of the instrument, and therefore IFRIC did not expect significant diversity in practice. Now, that was my thoughts in terms of the first one, and I think actually in relation to, if you like, the addendum, arguably by putting that in, says, hey, look at the facts, basically. But having said that, I actually, having listened to the discussions, I actually think that first sentence of paragraph 7 is actually quite important. Even if we only repeat it within the second paragraph, just to note that, because although it's not the intent, the representations, etc., the more, because when I read this addendum, my gut feeling without all the technical arguments was, I don't feel comfortable with this, whereas I did with the first one. It just didn't seem right that something as a long-term instrument could suddenly become a cash equivalent. And I think that's the feeling that is actually coming out from everyone around the table without perhaps necessarily the technical backing for it. But I think that it actually comes back to that first sentence in paragraph 7. Just in terms of the common sense reading of it, we're trying to, as Bruce said, in some ways we're trying to make this too damn hard by bifurcating it and et cetera, but really to say, if it is held broadly for the purpose of meeting short-term cash commitments rather than for investments or other purposes, if I had a 10-year bond, that is really, despite the fact that it may be redeemable tomorrow with a penalty, that's not cash. Now, Bob used the example of, and I agree that if you say, you know, I'll put in a deposit account that has zero interest versus I will do something else that has some interest, but if I do have to take it out, it gets a penalty, then yeah, I agree with Bob, because that is my intention. I'm thinking about my short-term cash requirement, and I'm thinking it's better off to try and earn some money on that, so I'll do it that way. But at the end of the day, I don't want to force people, and I totally agree that there shouldn't be a choice. It's either a cash equivalent or it ain't a cash equivalent. You can't make the decision other than by looking at the first sentence of paragraph 7. So somehow, and I think by bringing that in, yes, it becomes a judgment thing, but to me that is really important, and I think we then get away from our 10-year bond things, other than someone who clearly says, I'm going to take out this thing because I can, you know, I think I probably will redeem it early, but I could keep it and I could end up with some interest.
what I suggest then, having heard the comments, is that we modify the agenda decision. We're still only looking at paper 4, not the addendum, to include or to re-emphasize. So it's criteria of cash equivalence set out in paragraph 6 of IS 7, paragraph 7 of cash equivalence are held for the purpose of meeting short-term cash commitments rather than for investment or other purposes as the leader. So that's reminding people it's not management intent as such, I don't, my view of it, but we're simply saying this is what cash equivalents are meant to be. That's what the standard says. So we're emphasizing that. And then to continue with the discussion that we have in this paper, because I think that addresses all of the other issues and concerns that people have raised. Okay. But we have general agreement on that. Again, you get the detail of the words coming through. Staff happy with that approach? Yeah. And then if we turn to the addendum and the circumstances in the addendum, do you feel, in the light of the change that we've now made to this agenda decision, that we need to consider any other factors, or if that agenda decision is sufficiently clear, valid, binding on the circumstances described in the addendum? Ken?
Chairman, I would be happy with the wording we've got for rejection, and I feel I can fit the addendum into it. I do think that it puts us back into the position that Joanne was talking about, that there will be different judgments in relation to things. And the reason that I feel comfortable is, A, we've got the intent thing in now, which I think is important, and B, there's the last sentence of the rejection notice that talks about if the also noted the entity would have to satisfy itself that any investment was subject to an insignificant risk of change. And certainly I would read that as excluding some of the things I've talked about. Now, it may be that other people read it differently, but I think that's within the realms of the judgments I expect. So I'm happy that the rejection notice does address that properly, and I believe that it gets sensible answers.
All right, so that final sentence you feel is important, that any investment was subject to an insignificant risk of changes in value. We're not specifying it's a change in interest rate risk. We're not specifying it's a change in the current carrying amount.
We're leaving it up to judgment to determine what that means, and I think that's right.
All right. I don't see anybody objecting to that. So the two issues we put together, one for the wording. Do we need to just emphasize in the first paragraph that it's not just money market funds that we're talking about, or we have to leave it like that? Okay, I'm getting a message from the staff that the wording in the Appendix A to the main paper 4 is the introduction to the issue.
I think the question that came in actually said, or other funds, money market or other funds, and I think it might be worthwhile to put that back in because it was the other ones that were really the big worry.
Okay.